Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Wednesday, May 22nd from HPR2. It's The Conversation. Keeping up the fight to keep Ho'opili out.
No script change necessary when proclaiming truth is enough.
Getting out of hot water on the Big Island.
And catching a wave of experiential education.
Plus, the BBC World Report, rashes and boils and scabs. Oh, my. And a backyard big shot falls flat.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. In Eva, it only takes one word to start a fight. Ho'opili. Well, maybe four words when you add in Ad, Co, and Koa Ridge. The battle to turn current ag land to houses got a boost earlier this month when a judge upheld the Land Use Commission's decision to allow rezoning for urban use. Opponents may be disappointed, but they're not disheartened. They say they'll continue to appeal. And will take their case to the door of the Hawaii Supreme Court. Sierra Club Hawaii Chapter Director Robert Harris is here with a preview of their plans, insofar as he can actually talk about them. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This saga, and I guess there's no other word to really capture what this has been, because it's been so ongoing and it's so full and fraught with anxiety and emotion and passion, because people who feel one way, and feel the other way they do, and there's nothing much in between. Is there really going to be a point of resolution for this at the Supreme Court door? I mean, the Hawaii Supreme Court's door?
Yes. I mean, what we're doing here is the creators in the Hawaii State Constitution were very concerned about the amount of agricultural land that was being developed back in the 60s and 70s. And so they put in specific protections in the Constitution requiring us to really take a good, hard look before developing agriculture land. And the issue here that we're looking at for both Ho'opili and Koa Ridge, which are prime farmland that are commercially viable, it's been producing food, and some people have estimated roughly 30 to 40% of the food that was grown in Hawaii and eaten in Hawaii is produced from these two different farmlands. So what we're trying to do is make sure that the Supreme Court takes a look at the Constitution and says, you know, did the Land Use Commission really consider it appropriately when they made a decision to develop both these parcels?
But part of it, too, is being able to quantify what does important ag land really, really mean. That's where we have a little bit more trouble, because we know what the word important, and we certainly know what the words ag land mean, but what that constitutes together and how that becomes the defining line for what you can and can't use and what should or shouldn't be rezoned, despite, you know, whatever you might hear from the opposition, that you can move the ag land someplace else. It's all so fuzzy.
Plainly, and it's plain that the state of Hawaii has not done a good enough job at really looking at this issue. I mean, I was raised in Hawaii, and, you know, I've been hearing for 30 years now the importance of agriculture, and we need to do more diversified agriculture. And a lot of times it's just words. I mean, we're not really developing a good, strong plan to really look at how we're going to grow food for future, our, you know, the keiki of Hawaii. Putting that aside for a second, you know, if you look at these two parcels, have been producing food commercially for decades. They have the water resources. They have some of the best soil in the world. If any land was going to be defined as important agriculture land, this is it. I mean, a lot of times developers are pointing to lands on the North Shore and other areas, and I'm not trying to say those aren't important or aren't good ag lands, but they're currently not in commercial use. That's usually because they don't have water. They don't have access to markets. There's various reasons why they're not going strongly. These lands are. So if you're going to draw any distinction, you know, at least looking at what's currently producing food and saying, well, maybe we should be looking at those lands first. And unfortunately, we're not having that discussion.
Nevertheless, you still have this appeal that was sort of slashed and burned earlier in the month, and you say you're going to be carrying on with it. if the Land Use Commission doesn't understand what your definition is of best and highest use and important ag land, who needs to really decide that to make it definitive?
Yeah, we've set up a Land Use Commission, which is principally volunteers that are politically appointed. And, you know, if you look at the history of Land Use Commission, it's typically been either people who represent the development industry or trade unions that, you know, represent the development industry as well. And so it's not exactly
From conflict of interest in your point.
Correct. So, you know, the fact that the Land Use Commission approves development projects and historically has always approved development projects maybe, you know, is not surprising. And the reason why we have a judicial system is they're supposed to be a little bit above some of the political tensions, and they're supposed to be objective and be able to really analyze the law. And so that's what, you know, our hope is here, is that the Supreme Court is going to have the opportunity to do a careful examination and really sort of help define the criteria when, you know, that you know, what is protected, you know, under the Constitution and what is not. And that's what's needed here.
So what is the timeline on that look like? Because meanwhile, you've got Ho'opili looking as if it's going to continue along, and that's pretty much the line that Horton, Shuler Division says. Castle and Cook says they're going to continue along, all of that, until there's a reason for them not to. What else are they going to do? But this is going to be a very protracted fight.
It is, and you know, it is unfortunate that these things can't be resolved more quickly and more efficiently. And yet, that is our appellate process. It does take sometimes a year or two for, you know, the courts to go through the whole process and to make a decision. And you know, that's just what we're going to have to do. We are looking at trying to expedite it to try to have it done quicker. You know, and we'll make those efforts because I think it's everybody's interest to try to have a quicker, more confident resolution of this.
At this point, though, is there anything that you see happening with both of those developers that you know you're going to have to undo?
No, because both development projects are still going to have to go to the city council to get approval. And my suspicion is that the city is probably going to want to wait to see what happens with this resolution. So, you know,
its own best interest just to make sure that it won't have to undo anything either, perhaps.
Correct. Because if the city grants approval, it's hard for the city then to withdraw that approval later. So, you know, they almost in some ways want to make sure they're the last ones to give the final blessing.
So at this point, it's in a holding pattern until you can at least get it moving to the next level in the appellate process. But that very well likely might not be it either until you get up to the Hawaii Supreme Court. Do you have a horizon in your mind that we'll have a decision on this in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, maybe?
You know, long term, really what we have to move towards is maybe a better discussion within our society and within government about trying to make these decisions in a smarter, more holistic way. I mean, fundamentally, the issue for developers boils down to jobs and housing, and we need more jobs. We need more housing, but we have to have a better way of discussing where those, where the housing should be and what type of jobs we're creating, and that's really where we're failing. And if we could do that better, then maybe we could avoid some of these kinds of more protracted kinds of efforts, and you know, it doesn't serve anybody's interests.
You're also backing into a discussion about affordability when it comes to housing, and how that weight that in a discussion of best and highest use, in this case of ag land. All right, so we have nothing to do at this point but sit, wait, and watch for a little while longer. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you, Bethan.
Robert Harris is the director of the Sierra Club Hawaii chapter. He grew up in Kailua, attended UH from undergraduate days through law school. He serves on several boards and commissions, including the Hawaii State Bar Association, and says, as you just heard, if necessary, his organization is prepared to take the Ho'opili Koa Ridge case all the way to the Hawaii Supreme Court.
Hey, aloha, ananoha. Makani kaulana o kaina au e ho e no nerei kamakani kaulana.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. Later, not being a slave to screenplay drama, paddling bacterium home, and next, a not-so-poisonous pen.
Of all the travel writing about Hawaii, some of the best includes the 25 letters written by a young reporter named Samuel Clemens. You probably know him better by his pen name, Mark Twain. In 1866, Twain was hired by the Sacramento Union to write about what was then called the Sandwich Islands. On March 17th, the former steamboat captain set out for his first sea voyage and arrived in Honolulu 11 days later. Traveling by horseback and on foot, he went everywhere from Kilauea Iki Crater on the Big Island to Diamond Head on Oahu, and along the way he penned humorous and often thought-provoking letters about the people he met and the activities that filled his days. But one might surprise you. On a trip across the western coast of the Big Island, Twain tried and failed at an all-time favorite Hawaii activity. For today's quiz, can you guess what it was? We'll tell you the rest of the story next half hour.
Hi, good morning. I'm Connie Flores from Hula Girl Productions. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
It's one of the benefits of success as a performer, the ability to lend your presence and your drawing power in support of something that captures your heart. Through the benefit performances they give, musicians show us what gets their attention. Barry Flanagan believes in experiential education to care for the environment. His program of choice is Nalu Studies, which will get the star and guitar treatment this weekend on Oahu's North Shore. Barry Flanagan is with us this morning. Good morning, Barry.
Morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on. How are you?
All right.
Good.
You know, it's nice to be able to say to somebody, yeah, I can do a show for you, and it'll help you out, help your place out, yeah?
Well, it's the best of both worlds.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think so.
What is it about Nalu Studies that motivated you to sort of do a benefit show for them?
The founder and executive director's name is Manning Tate III. He's a scientist. We've been kind of by proxy presidents of each other's fan club for about 20 years.
Uh-huh.
I met Manning when he was attending school 20 years ago when we were touring in Davis. And we've just kept in touch, and I guess we've watched each other grow over almost two decades. Nalu's main purpose and mission statement is taking Hawaii's high-risk teens and leading by example, turning them into tomorrow's environmental leaders. So an incredibly ambitious thing that that Manning took on, founded, and is the executive director of.
And it's really about finding something to kind of attach your life to, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, he does. It's funny because being a songwriter, he knows my hours. So he's one of the few guys that I could call up at 3 a.m. and he's usually up working and I'm up writing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But, you know, you've seen through your life and the lives of, we've all seen through the lives of ourselves and friends, what happens to you when you attach yourself to something. You pick the guitar, you pick whatever as a kind of a path in life. It changes everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It really becomes an extension of you, what you're about, so flaws and all, right?
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, is there something that kind of, it's important to have a kind of higher purpose, whatever that might be.
That's so true. I agree. I think that with this program that I love the fact that I can attach Hapa to it. I feel so honored to be able to have us involved as a little bit of the soundtrack for Manning and his vision.
Well, let's get into a little bit of that soundtrack, Barry. You're playing slack key, and you've been loyal to the same guitar you started out with, which got a great big hole in the top, and a beautiful sound. Yeah.
Thank you.
What tuning are you in now?
This is actually one of the only tunings I know. I'm not really a traditional slack key player. Ledward Ka'apana refers to this as New Jersey slack key.
Showing that slack key has indeed spread around the world, right?
That's right. The tuning, though, is interesting, as Jorma Kekkonen uses it for Water Song in Hot Tuna, uh-huh. and Peter Frampton uses the same tuning for Penny for Your Thoughts.
Huh. Nice.
So it wasn't that hard for me to get a handle on the tuning 30-something years ago after I heard Ry Cooder and Gabby. I wanted to get a little bit of a handle on slack key stuff. So.
And Ry Cooder was really somebody who taught the rest of the world about what slack key was.
He was
right?
The bridge for me, and I think so many. I think for you too, right, on a lot of levels.
Absolutely.
It's great to see that music be so prominently featured in The Descendants a couple of years ago. It was like, hey, look, it only took the world 40 years. But it was great nonetheless, you know, Alexander Payne doing that.
Well, let's hear a little taste of what you got there.
I was just thinking, I was in Chicago about a month ago playing blues on the radio. Uh-huh. I was like, what would be fitting for... This is a tune called Nani Poli Poli from Maui.
That was just really sweet, Barry.
I haven't had coffee yet, so there's a few wrong notes.
Who notices?
Happens. Like I said, warts and all. Right.
Well, you know, there's some beautiful use of, and this is a thing that some people tend to leave out of their music, which is dynamics. And there's some really strong differences between the loudest volume and the softest volume of that piece you
I
just
agree.
Played.
Spoken
right?
by a true... musicality kind of guy.
Well,
that's exactly
I mean,
right. You can change a song dramatically by just lowering the volume on parts A and B.
It's easy to forget to do that, isn't it? And just you keep sort of pounding something out at the same volume in it. But I really was struck when you played that by how much dimension it adds to the music.
I agree. Thank you.
Barry, great to have you on
Thanks
the show.
Thanks so much for having me on. Wow.
You sound great
awesome.
As always. Good to have you.
Support MTR.
Tell me about your, what's the time and date of your performance this weekend?
This Saturday, it's at Turtle Bay Hotel. There's a beautiful little, about a 200-seat intimate room there called Surfer the Bar.
Uh-huh.
Fell in love with the room when we did an outdoor concert there about 6 months ago.
They've been having a lot of music there. What's the and it's Saturday? What time?
Saturday, two shows. 7 o'clock is all ages. Uh-huh. Then there's a 9:15, you know, 9:30 show. Special guests are Miss Hawaii USA Radasha Ho'ohuli will be performing hula, and our good buddy Kealoha Slam Poetry Master and Poet Laureate will be there.
Fantastic, Barry. Thanks a lot.
Hapa.com for all info.
All right, excellent. Barry Flanagan is the leader of Hapa, and you just heard that he'll be performing this Saturday on the North Shore. You can learn more about him and his music on HPR2.org. Excuse me.
President Obama offers federal aid and support to tornado victims. The immigration bill navigates its way through Congress. Rand Paul gives money to the New Hampshire GOP. And IRS officials testify before the Senate Finance Committee. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HBR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Grace Hu of Kailua, Kate Moore of Wahiawa, and Jane Boynton of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:27. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Each year, hundreds of canoe racers, kids, and adults paddle out into the murky waters of the Alawai Canal. But the water, by the state's own standards, isn't safe for recreation. So why doesn't the state just shut it down? CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check, part three of a discussion we've been having about, a very deep, dark, and rather ugly part of our city. You can't even see any of it when you look straight down. What are we doing at this point, though we know that these standards can't possibly be met?
You know, just to start off, let me set the scene a little bit. Sophie Koch, our reporter, actually spoke to some paddlers and others, and they regularly contract staph infections, eye, ear, throat infections. We talked to one mother terrified that her daughter in a canoe is going to be turned over and start, you know, drinking that Alawai water.
But not terrified enough not to be there and to be part of it.
Right, exactly. It's a very popular inland waterway. It's flat, nice opening to the Pacific Ocean. You're asking why hasn't the state shut it down? I think there's a number of reasons. One, there really isn't the will or the financial resources, money lacking at both the state and federal level. If they're going to focus on a poison waterway, they're looking at Hanalei Bay, for example, or West Maui, areas where they think they can do more good. Let me just read a quote from you from a – this is rather shocking – from a former state official. Why don't we shut this thing down? Quote, "We don't have bodies lying in the street. That is where there would be a serious investigation and enforcement. Yes, people do get infections and they get sick and the infections clear up and not much is done." I mean, that somewhat captures the attitude of at least a former health official why they don't shut the thing down.
Yeah, June Harrigan Lum. But honestly, right, the question that we're asking is, well, how sick is sick and how much is okay? Clearly, by the fact that people are still willing to use it and there's not the will to shut it down, it doesn't matter if the bacteria counts are off the charts. It's going to stay open and be of use, and people can just be quietly hysterical, I suppose. All right, Chad, we'll
exactly.
Pick it up again tomorrow.
Look forward to it, Beth Ann. Thank you.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. I've got Bert on the line to talk about this afternoon's show. And, Bert, what does the term maker mean as it's now being applied?
Well, that's a very good question, Chris, because, you know, that's what I was going to ask our guest. What is it that really makes somebody a maker? Now, obviously, you would think, well, you know, if you make furniture or you make some electronics or maybe you make some mechanical device, you can be considered a maker. I would consider maybe even all the artists out there are makers. But,
oh, yeah.
But nowadays, there's a lot more activity going on with sort of like 3D printing and designing things and creating some ideas that perhaps would be difficult to do, you know, just with regular types of traditional lathes and saws and what have you. So there's a combination of I think, you know, wood shop and tech that's mm-hmm. Sort of mashed together, and then what you end up with is a maker.
Well, you know, 3D printing is an example of a technology that you can't have 25 years experience in because it didn't exist 25 years ago. So it's kind of... it's kind of a new craft being created in front of us, isn't it?
That's true. And, you know, before when you think about getting, let's say, a printer, I mean, it'd be, you know, I guess long ago it was a very expensive thing to get, just a regular, you know, 2D printer. But then, you know, nowadays you can get a printer for pretty cheap. Now, the 3D printers started maybe about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and they were pretty expensive. But nowadays they're pretty much available for a lot of these maker spaces, so they're all going into the 3D printing mode as well. So a lot of interesting things going on. I think it's a resurgence of the idea of doing hands-on creation of stuff, and it's encouraging to see, you know, this movement take place in Hawaii. So we invited a couple of folks that represent maker spaces, one from High Capacity and the Oahu Maker Space, and they're getting together. They just came back from a San Francisco Maker Fair, and we wanted to get their insights on that and plans perhaps to have a mini Maker Fair here in Hawaii.
Sounds great, Bert. Thanks very much. We'll look forward to that. That's tonight at Bite Marks Cafe, tonight at 5 o'clock.
March 13th wasn't particularly noteworthy to you. It wasn't the date of the Ides of March, but to Puno residents, it might well have been. That afternoon, Helco tripped offline and off went the steam release mechanism at Puno Geothermal Venture, and that triggered state civil defense and terse response from folks who want to relocate. Bill 78 would allow funds to help them do that. District 4 Councilman Gregor Ilagan and the rest of the Hawaii County Council members will be considering it next week. Gregor Ilagan joins us by phone now. Good morning.
Morning, Beth. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. And some other people may feel they're doing much better if, in fact, Bill 78 allows you to take monies that are now being held in that relocation and community fund and shoot it only for relocation.
That's right. It was funny how this came to be, because the planning department, our director, came before the council, and I was wondering what was going on with this $1 million, because in the provision, it had a minimum balance of $1 million shall be maintained in the fund for expenditures relating to geothermal relocation. So why wasn't it being spent? Well, because of the legal side of it, it emphasized on a minimum balance of $1 million shall be maintained. So they thought it should be in that fund and not being used. So to release that money, I had to strike out that provision and let them be able to use it for relocation.
There are other, you know, the idea of having community benefits, other benefits that might be attached to this geothermal related, but are you getting any pushback from any parts of the community saying, but wait a minute, if you shoot the whole thing to relocation, it disadvantages somebody else in the community?
Well, what happened is this is a very unique situation that the amount of applicants that's applying for relocation is actually more than the fund itself. There's 5 million, 5 million that actually takes care of all the applicants for relocation, and there's only $3 million in the fund. So we have more applicants requesting for relocation, and the priority of this fund is for relocation. So that's why I'm trying to make sure all the money is being spent for relocation.
And for the original purpose intended. And sometimes we've seen funds that have been set up for a specific purpose co-opted into something else. But what happens now, Gregor, when you've got $3 million in the fund, $5 million that would be necessary to help all those who want to relocate to actually do it? What happens to those other people who are in the latter part of the queue? They haven't been able to, I guess, get their applications up to the front of the line yet.
That's right, Beth. And what happens with this geothermal relocation fund is that every year, depending on the amount of volume that PGV produce, is the amount of revenue it brings in. So every year it's roughly around $800K. And so next year we'll have a little bit more money to make sure that these individuals would be relocated.
Well, if you, depending upon how you spend that initial $3 million, right? Because if there is the ability now to spend, or if this goes through, the ability to spend all of it, then won't you only have only $800,000 next year?
Exactly.
And then you'll have to just parse it out as it can be done so that people will get it as it's available, and that may take 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, there are a lot of people who say they don't want to wait that long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I could, I wish I could just pull it out the air. But it's one of those things that we are working with our limited resources available to be able to help out these individuals who want to relocate.
Do they understand that?
Oh, yes. They're aware.
So they're not giving you any push that somehow everybody should happen at the same time, that they're okay with waiting their turn?
Yes. They are coming to my office and letting me know that how's this relocation process going, and I let them know on what's going on and what we could do to make it more efficient.
So how many people will be affected immediately who will be able to relocate if this goes through?
Right now, we're sending it to a realtor firm to make sure the assessment and everything is getting taken care of. And that's what our planning department is doing. And right now, it's going through that process. So until we get that report back, then we'll have more up-to-date data for that.
And when do you expect the report to come back to you?
I actually don't know that, Beth. I would have to talk to the planning department and see where they're at on that now.
Meanwhile, you all are going to be looking at the latest draft of Bill 78 on the 29th.
Yes, ma'am.
And if you had to create some sort of probability statement for this bill, is it going to pass?
Well, I can't predict the future on that. Otherwise, I'd be in another business.
But you're going to...
I hope it could pass because this is the bill that I'm spearheading, and depending on how the council feels, I'm one of nine, and I don't know what my colleagues are going to decide to vote on.
But you've been talking about this.
Oh, yes. It came before. This is actually what has happened is on May 29th, it's going to be coming before the council for the first time in discussion. So that's when we're going to be discussing it for the first time. It hasn't been deliberated in council yet. Does that make sense, Beth?
Oh, of course it does. But you must know exactly how some of your fellow council members feel.
Oh, because of the Sunshine violation, we're not about, we can't talk about board business more than two people.
Oh, of course not. But, I mean, just from what has already been done and has already been discussed, knowing that this is not going to be an easy fix for you.
Gotcha.
At this point, I guess we have the same thing going on for us is you're going to be doing, and that's just waiting until May 29th.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, we'll be watching. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Beth.
Gregory Lagon was born in the Philippines and moved to Hawaii when he was just 7. He's now 5 months into his first term as the councilman from Hawaii Islands District 4. He ran for a seat with public funding, by the way. Bill 78 to shift monies to a permanent relocation fund comes up before the Hawaii County Council on May 29th. And you can read the bill on our new website, hpr2.org.
I got steam heat. I got steam heat. I got steam heat. But I need your love to keep away the cold. I got steam heat. I got steam heat. I got
Mark Twain is still one of the greatest American humorists, and Hawaii did not escape his pen. In 1866, Twain arrived to cover happenings in the Sandwich Islands for the Sacramento Union newspaper. He toured the kingdom from Kilauea Iki Crater to Diamond Head, often on foot or horseback, and tried many activities he'd never have attempted back home in Missouri. His travels are titled Mark Twain in Hawaii, Roughing It in the Sandwich Islands. It's available at most libraries and free on our website. And if you do give it a look, you might notice on page 501 there's a picture of Mark Twain cowabungling, one of Hawaii's most famous sports. And in this morning quiz, we asked you to name it. Yes, it was surfing, or surf bathing, as Twain called it. Either way, he also called it a failure. That's it for today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.com.
Hi, I'm Franco Amurri, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
It's one of the defining documents of our history. All persons held as slaves in rebellious areas shall be then, thenceforward, and forever free. We're in the 150th anniversary year of the Emancipation Proclamation, and it's a reminder of something we should never forget, that the United States was once a nation whose economy was largely built on slavery, and that we were once torn in half over the issue by one of the most destructive conflicts the world had ever seen. UH Hilo history professor Jeff Smith is part of a weekend symposium on Abraham Lincoln and the Proclamation, and he joins us by phone. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
You know, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And, you know, I have a question that's always sort of dogged me about the Emancipation Proclamation.
Sure.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's easy to get the perception that it magically freed the slaves, but most of the people to whom it applied were in a rebel state. So this was a proclamation toward people who were not affected by it. Is that an accurate description?
Somewhat. I mean, it's a variation on it. The proclamation, when it's issued, intentionally doesn't apply to states in rebellion where the Union doesn't have control. It's intentionally targeted towards areas only where you have to have two things. One, be in a state of rebellion, and two, have the Union military have control of the region. So if you don't fall under that category, be it a border state in the north,
or
in the deep south someplace where the Union military still hasn't showed up, slavery is still most definitely in action.
Yeah, that's the perception, I guess, that, I just hate for the perception to get out that it somehow ended slavery. The peculiar institution kept on quite a while after that, didn't it?
Yes, it did. For those people that saw the Lincoln movie, that was part of the reason for that movie and for the 13th Amendment there. was to formally end slavery, because the proclamation itself was freeing the slaves in the Confederate states where the Union held sway there. But as far as a legal standing, it didn't end slavery as a law in the U.S.
Yeah, that's it kind of, because it's over the issue of jurisdiction. I mean, half the country was not under the control of the federal government, yeah?
Yeah, and that's part of the explanation for the Emancipation Proclamation, is that Lincoln is citing his war powers.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're citing your war powers to justify doing this, it obviously makes it highly problematic then to try and extend it to the border states that are, in fact, not in a state of rebellion. So it's very selective and, purposely so, crafted to really be only in areas where the Union can implement this in the South as somewhat of a punitive measure to the South, but then also to gain a kind of higher calling, if you will, to the war and helped to basically keep foreign recognition from the South.
Well, we now tend to look at the war between the states and the North effort as kind of a moral effort, I think that overlooks the place that slavery had in the economy of the entire nation.
Yeah, slavery was very important for both the North and the South. Even in the North, where slavery is illegal, much of that southern cotton goes to textile manufacturers in the North. Much of what the North produces is sold to the South. So you've got an economic connection there as well. And something that I think a lot of times gets misrepresented as well, too, is that somehow the North is distinctly somehow morally superior to the South in this regard.
Exactly, yeah.
And that there's plenty of people in the North that despise and hate slavery, or what they term slave power, but yet in the same breath are perfectly fine denigrating African Americans and viewing them as racially inferior,
mm-hmm.
and that the two ideas of racial equality and slavery are really separate, and for generations never the twain shall meet.
Lincoln wasn't really about racial equality, was he?
Initially there, no. He's someone that, by a lot of accounts, kind of evolves on the issue there of slavery and racial equality and mm-hmm. kind of comes around to it. But, from the outset of the war there, no, ending slavery was not a war aim. Racial equality from the beginning was not a war aim.
Would he have been willing to end the war between the states without abolishing slavery?
I think early on there may have been a chance for something like that, but fairly soon that idea, I think, is eschewed for the idea of connecting slavery with it, considering that slavery was such a central causal effect of the war. To somehow end the war but yet not discuss it or not settle the issue, considering that you still have a large percentage of the western United States that aren't yet states themselves and are just territories and regions that obviously we're going to have to go through statehood, to end the war and then still have this lingering issue that's going to repeatedly come up again in future years, I think he very quickly, as well as plenty of other people, realized that was highly problematic.
Well, also, in the aftermath of, particularly of Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel, right, The Little Lady Whose Novel Started the Big War,
sure.
There's a lot of moral fervor attached. Once the war got underway, that anti-slavery moral fervor kind of got attached to it, didn't it?
Yeah. The moral fervor was definitely there in the abolitionist community.
Sure.
Outside of them, those that fought and championed the war for the sake of the Union, those were the ones that usually it took a little bit longer to kind of, gain a little traction there for them. But fairly quickly, once you start talking about emancipation and it comes out, everyone pretty much, starts rallying to the cause, if you will.
Well, and the only reason I bring these things up at all, Jeff, is that it goes toward the whole idea that history tends to be a lot more ambiguous, that it doesn't go into these good versus evil paradigms, that there are all these nuances to human behavior and the motivations behind government action, yeah?
Yeah, there's plenty of nuance. And again, the idea that somehow the North is morally superior, or that the South was morally bankrupt, really overgeneralizes to a fault what was going on. That you have plenty of people in the North that like slavery. You have
sure.
Democrats in the North that want to protect slavery because they're worried, and the usual pitch is to get voters to vote Democrat, that if you free the slaves are going to come to the North. The slaves are going to take your jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That type of a pitch. So as a result, usually you get a fair amount of Democrats in the North actively, even during the Civil War, that are okay with slavery.
Well, and didn't you have riots in New York City, you know, sort of race riots of when they started drafting New Yorkers? They sort of turned on the local black population in anger. You kind of got me into this.
Yeah. Race riots happened in a few different areas as far as that goes. And when you start, you know, again, thanks to the Emancipation Proclamation, basically turn those that were being liberated into liberators themselves, and you have African Americans serving in the U.S. military, there's plenty of people in the military at that time, from military officials on down to your just regular service member, that are very unhappy with that and threaten to leave or, you know, basically turn their backs on the war effort now that African Americans are being included. So it's a very, you know, a tumultuous time.
Well, you know, Jeff, when you examine history in greater detail and you find out that it's less cut and dried than it might have been presented to you initially, it gets more interesting, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think when you oversimplify things, and I think that's where sometimes when people discuss slavery and the Civil War from a very kind of cursory standpoint, it can seem all very, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like superficial and very basic and straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
But that once you dig past that, all of the subtle nuance and all of the arguments that went back and forth and the kind of what ifs and the almost could have happened makes it considerably more interesting and more engaging. And when you really start talking about it, that's what gets people excited, in my opinion, and that's what gets people interested in history.
Well, Jeff, it really is a fascinating subject, and thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Jeffrey Smith is an assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Hawaii at Hilo. He's part of the James Oliver Horton Symposium on Abraham Lincoln this Saturday in Hilo and this Sunday at UH Manoa, and details are on hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering the exceptional checking account, which includes an identity theft protection package that alerts users if personal information is compromised. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
This week on Radiolab,
this.
The big mystery. How it is that just a bunch of these
little wisps of jelly in your head, called neurons,
flashing on and off in your brain, create
thoughts, ambitions, passions,
you,
even what you think of as your own intimate self,
and how, in a flash, that could all change.
In an instant, we can be completely transformed.
I'm Jad Abumrad. Join me for Radiolab.
Saturday morning at 10. Support for today's programming comes from Diamond Head Theater. On stage next is the musical The Goodbye Girl, featuring the tunes of Marvin Hamlisch, opening this Friday. Tickets and information at diamondheadtheater.com.
Chris, you just talked with Jeff Smith about the Lincoln Symposium, and it's not just a view toward the past that he's talking about. He maybe have talked about the Civil War and Lincoln's perspectives changing and everyone's perspectives changing if you look more deeply into it, but really it's a bit of a cautionary tale for the rest of us, too, as we look at anything now. It's not just that sanitized, simplified version that's so easy to bottom line. There's so much more nuance there. There's so many more perspectives on that continuum that really shape the entire argument and why we can't, in his case, say, okay, the North had the moral high ground and the South was the big, bad, ugly one. This is not black hats and white hats or rather gray and blue hats. It's just that there's so much more that we need to look for.
And we talked, and when he referred to how people in the North had been benefiting for generations from slavery in terms of the lower price of goods, it's not that much of a stretch to look at today, and maybe even some of the clothes on our backs that are inexpensive because the people who made them don't get paid an awful lot. We are still talking about human trafficking. It's 2013, so, you know, the whole thing, we fought a war against slavery and the good guys won, is just way too superficial.
And the truth of the matter is that we hear it every day and sometimes don't exactly pay as much attention to it and connect it back to our own history. That's going to do it for us, though, for this morning. We'll be back tomorrow talking about creating public policy with your feet on a farm.
And a look at the hidden history revealed by Hawaii's sunken wrecks.
You can check out our new website, hpr2.org, and tell us what you think about it, or frankly, anything else. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at Because HPR.
Past shows, links to more information, and lots of other good things are on the archive on the new and, we hope, easy to remember website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you back here in the morning for more of The Conversation.